Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming this morning and giving me the opportunity to speak about something close to my heart, racism and how I and we can contribute to creating a world where all people are truly free. I'm here because my heart breaks at the racism all around us, and I believe that your heart breaks as well at the racism all around us. Yet knowing how to help maybe isn't so clear. Racism and how it's woven into our society is very complex. I certainly don't have a magic bullet and will not be telling you what to do. There is no way I can know your journeys around racism. I'm new to the community. I've been a member since March. So, So I plan today to share my journey and the lessons and things that I have found useful. I've had the good fortune to become very close to a good handful of people, non-white and white, who've been very generous and deep teachers about the impact of our country's foundational and ongoing racism for Black, Brown, Indigenous, and Asian individuals, families, and communities, and its impact on me and my loved ones and family and community. We're all harmed by racism woven into our culture. So please listen or say along these opening words, a song written by Billy Taylor, a Black man for his daughter. And afterwards, check out the version sung by Nina Simone, and you'll hear the longing of a Black woman to be free. All right, so opening words slide, George. So feel free to say these along with me if you'd like. I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I could say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me, and then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do. Though I'm way overdue, I'd be starting anew. Well, I wish I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be if I found I could fly. I'd soar to the sun and look down at the sea. And I'd sing 'cause I'd know. I'd sing 'cause I'd know. I'd sing 'cause I'd know. I know how it feels. I know it how it feels to be free. Let's listen now to a piece of music that's a traditional Negro spiritual. And while you're listening, can you imagine being an enslaved person and the excitement, fear, and flow of energy that you might have thinking God was creating a disturbance in the water, an opening for change? Our world, God caused or not, or however it's caused, is in disturbance. The waters are swirling as we transition from a fairly stable post-World War II world to something else. This piece can speak to us today, for us to wade in the water and help craft a future where all people are free. Thank you, Doreen. Doreen stepped in just like to help me out, so thankful. And I have to say, Peter's service last week is a hard act to follow. So, give me a little grace here. All right. Could you put up the slide? Curiosity evokes concern. It evokes the care one takes for what exists and what could exist, a readiness to find strange and singular what surrounds us, a certain relentlessness to break up our familiarities and to regard otherwise the same things, a fervor to grasp what is happening and what passes. Michael Foucault, the masked philosopher. invite you to engage your curiosity this morning, to let go of your thinking mind, anything you're holding onto in regards to this topic, and be curious as to what feelings, thoughts, and emotions arise and move through you. So much we can learn this way. I'm part of Boulder Surge, Showing Up for Racial Justice, a chapter of the national organization founded by and for white people who want to help create a world without racism. At Boulder Surge, a foundational practice in our anti-racism work is to be grounded and to stay grounded so that we can feel what it is going on there. In our white culture, our white culture is one of intellectualizing and avoiding a grounded presence in our bodies. And when we are grounded, we can build our capacity to feel challenging things, to live with uncertainty, which is so hard to live with. So let's take a more, a resource for this is the book, My Grandmother's Hands by Resume Menicum. Has anyone read that? Yeah, it's a great book to work through with people. So as we begin, I invite you to engage your curiosity and make grounding a practice, at least for the next 30 minutes. Take a moment again to feel your seat and your feet. Take a breath into your belly. And feel free to sit or stand, you know, through the next 30 minutes. You don't have to stay sitting. So today I'm going to talk from the perspective of anti-Black racism, as most of my teachers have been Black, and it's really just what I've studied the most. It's not to diminish the oppression of other groups in any way. It's kind of a way to focus today. I do believe the foundation of what I'm saying applies to other groups that are oppressed. There's no way I can know your individual journeys and experiences around racism or the journey of this fellowship. I know that I can learn something from each of you today, just as I hope you can learn something useful from me. So I own what I say today as my own journey from my experiences, trainings, teachers, ongoing study, and trying to take action. I believe what I'm going to say about racism in our world today has a solid backing in good research. So I'm going to make generalizations about racism, about Black people, white people, and trust that each of you can and will identify where you are on any specific item. Before I retired, I worked with a Boston-based nonprofit called the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. I was connected with them for over 20 years. The last 15 years was a senior project director. It's not overstating things to say that we changed how healthcare is delivered around the world. IHI applies the science of improvement to healthcare problems to learn what changes will produce higher quality and help teams at the front line make those changes so that healthcare outcomes are the best possible. Think fewer infections, higher childhood immunization rates, you know, those kinds of things. Well, after 20 years, something not so great emerged. The work that we were doing actually widened equity gaps. The gaps for the outcomes, take any outcome you want, for white people versus non-white people, with the gaps for Black people being the worst, or the biggest gaps. And to be clear, by outcomes, we mean things like immunizations, pain management, pregnancy outcomes, chronic diseases and their management, and the length of one's life. So really important things. How could this be? It certainly wasn't anyone's intention. The opposite actually was the intention. In a nutshell, it boiled down to we were mostly white people doing that work. The staff at IHI was probably 99% white. The teams of doctors, nurses, social workers, and others that would come work with us and then make the changes back at their own healthcare institutions were mostly white. So we were applying a white worldview to diagnosing the problems, to potential solutions, to go about how change is made, the whole thing. And it worked really well for white people. It worked well for white patients. Outcomes were better. It worked well for white staff. The culture and everything they were asked to do, it worked. But for non-white people, it didn't work. It made it worse. The solutions didn't fit. Sometimes the solutions made things worse. It widened the equity gaps. So we had to do something. Oh, the other thing. Quality improvement is heavily data-driven, and the data here is very clear. So we had to do something different, but again, the question is, you know, how to change, what to change. A mentor of mine, Dr. Debbie Mixon Mitchell, a facilitator when I took the 2020 Facing Racism program of the Soul to Soul Sisters organization in Denver, says, effective racial social justice requires an inward focus. At IHI, through our work, once we started trying to address this, I found this to be true. We had to look at ourselves, our thought patterns, how our teams were structured, how we went about our work, what our beliefs were and our principles that we were, that had become the norm and kind of the rules of behavior that were part of the problem. We had to find out how the impact of our own behavior was different from our intent. Myself and many other white people learned what a very superficial education we had in the whole topic of racism. We learned that our behavior was right in line with a culture, now very clearly documented, called white supremacy culture. It was a big awakening, and many parts of it were very painful and challenging, but it was joyful, too. It released creativity and innovation. It changed relationships in a way that deepened them and enriched them. Really, it felt good to get out of that constraining box. And it feels good to me today. So that's kind of backstory. Let's look at some definitions of racism and who's a racist. So racist, when you hear that word, what images and words come to you? Now's the time for grounding and just maybe close your eyes. We're going to take a minute here. Just notice what you feel. Try not to censure. Just what comes up, what you feel, what images might come up. What flows through you? Does your heart quicken? A burst of energy go through? Some panic? Some joy, whatever. Just let it emerge and flow. Notice. And just take a big deep breath. For many, images of the KKK or violent white supremacists, such as we saw at Charlottesville more than a couple years ago now, or the January 6th people who stormed our Capitol, those kind of things come to mind. Maybe police beating or killing black people. So if you were to be called a racist, likely you would experience it as a terrible thing and vehemently deny it. Take a deep breath. Many of us feel shame, guilt, deep sadness when we get into these waters. While it's important to feel what you feel and to let that go, not hold yourself back from that, please do not hold on to these feelings. They are about what has been done, started centuries ago, and you can free up that energy for presence today. Think back to the great lessons we heard last week from Peter to be present today. So don't not feel them, but don't hold on to them. Let them flow through. If you feel anger, defensiveness, honor those feelings, but be curious about them. Investigate with an open mind and heart. And I felt all these things. If we had all afternoon, I could tell you a lot of stories. It's just human to feel these things. Like, oh, okay, damn. Just go with it. So the word racism is actually a descriptive term and not a pejorative term. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary says that racism is, there's a slide here, George, thank you. A belief that race is the primary determinant of human traits and capacities, and that racial differences produce an inherent superiority of a particular race. It is likely that if you are here in your conscious mind, in your belief systems, you don't believe this. You likely believe that, as I do, that we are all human and we are all equal, and that the hierarchy of white supremacy is made up. Well, in this you are correct. Back in the 1500s, 1600s in Europe, those in power and looking to build their own personal wealth came up with and pushed this belief system into academics, government, and churches. It was a way to justify the exploitation of non-white countries in the beginning of organized slavery. These beliefs then became the norm for the common people. It is what was heard in church, it was seen in law, and in practice. By being the norm, it became an invisible choice. These are very well documented in a book called Stamped from the Beginning by Ibram X. Kendi. It's about, 3 inches thick. I've read about a third of it, but it changed my whole understanding of racism. So it's a worthy thing to take a look at. So racism is designed into our culture. Racist policies started centuries ago are alive and working today. This society, based on the belief that white people are inherently better than non-white people, was imported into North America. And as the country grew, those in power, including, this breaks my heart when I read this, and it's not his opinion. He documents this very well. those in power, including almost all faith leaders. There are a few Quakers and a few UUs that kind of didn't believe it. Adopted this thinking and behaving, and in service of power and greed. White supremacy culture is the foundation for the United States of America. Thing is, it's alive today. Pick any statistic you want, and the data is significantly worse for Black Americans than white. Oppression is historic, systemic, and ongoing. We are all racists. In that racist policies create and sustain a dominant culture based on the belief that whites are superior. So I just called I'm a racist. Y'all are racists. But we'll get into that a little bit more. Take a deep breath and ground and just feel what comes up. And it might be unpleasant or it might be okay, but just, can you just feel your seat and your feet. Take a deep breath. Just let it move through your body. And feel free to move if you want. It helps to get it out. We did not ask for it. We do not want it. We do our best to stand up for all people's freedom. The issue is the culture embeds itself into us long before we're choosing our own beliefs and values. There's a slide here, George. There's a phenomenon called implicit bias. We have attitudes or stereotypes that affect our understanding, actions, and decisions in an unconscious manner. These biases are activated involuntarily and without an individual's awareness or intentional control. This probably isn't new to you. It happens outside of race as well. Gender stereotypes, class, all kinds of stuff. The implicit associations in our subconscious cause us to have feelings and attitudes about other people based on characteristics such as race, ethnicity, age, and appearance. These associations are developed over the course of a lifetime, beginning at a very early age, through exposure to direct and indirect messages, life experiences, media, that kind of thing. So we're guilty of being human. Our nervous systems are wired to make sense and filter and organize and this is what happens. So just take a moment and think about where you might have some implicit biases. It might be around gender, race. Can you identify any that you might, that you've run into in yourself? Like, oh. I was walking the other day at the Edgemont Golf Course, and a man and woman were walking their dog. Their skin was brown. I took them to be Hispanic and found myself thinking that he had a day off from a landscaping job. It surfaced, this thought, unasked for and immediate. My thinking self was able to stop that right away, and I bookmarked another instance of racism surfacing in me. The best I can do, because I can't, those things just come up. Like, damn, where did that come from? That's not me. That's not who I want to be me. Understanding implicit bias and how it works has helped me to deal with feelings of shame, guilt, and anger that have paralyzed me in the past. In a sense, it's not my fault that these stereotypes emerge, but I do have the responsibility. The power that I have over this is to learn what mine are and to assure that my self-awareness is such that I notice them and stop them as soon as possible and make that choice. Oh, that's not me. That's not going to be me right then and there. I'm not perfect, never will be. I don't believe it can be eradicated from a person. I do feel like we can get much better at it. But maybe we can. It'd be cool if it could be eradicated. I'd go for that. So this is a lot. Let's take a moment and process it through. I'm going to invite you maybe to stand. I want people to be silent, but stand or stay in your seat and just move around a bit. It does help just for it to move through. A lot of energy happens. A lot of things move through. Take a big, deep breath into your belly. And just let whatever happens, happen. Can you let that energy go? Engage your curiosity. It's like, wow, why do I feel angry? Why do I feel sad? It's a spurge of joy. Because I recognized this the other day, whatever it is. Yeah. And those of you on Zoom, please, hopefully you're also moving around and shaking it out. So the real issue is, what do we do with this? Now, feel free to stand and move. But the issue is, what do we do with this knowledge? In his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, Embrun X. Kendi defines a racist as one who is supporting a racist policy through their actions or inaction or expressing a racist idea. He goes farther and defines an anti-racist, one who is supporting an anti-racist policy through their actions or expressing an anti-racist idea. For him and many Black people, each person is one or the other. Kendi goes on to say, and there's a slide here, George, there is no neutrality in the racism struggle. The opposite of racist isn't not racist. One is either endorses the idea of racial hierarchy as a racist or racial inequality as an anti-racist. One either allows racial inequalities to persevere as a racist or confronts racial inequalities as an anti-racist. There's no safe space as a not racist. His words and the words of many Black leaders today are a call to action. But there are many, many different kinds of actions. Working on implicit bias, to me, is a huge one. Recently, I was speaking to a member of this fellowship, and the person said, well, I don't do actions for racial issues. And they were meaning I don't go out and protest and do those kinds of things. But they said, I do try and speak up when my family says racist things. They try and make fun of me and deflect it. Recently, I talked with a neighbor who I was friendly with about some racist remarks they made, and now they don't talk to me. From my perspective, this is a deep action, speaking out when important relationships can be threatened, the potential for impact here, in my view, is much bigger than if someone holding signs on a street. And holding signs on the street is important, but it's just part of the spectrum, because their actions in their daily life ripple out like pebbles thrown in water. Many took to the streets after the world witnessed George Floyd being murdered by a police officer, and rightly so. Where are these people now? How are they following through in their daily lives? Are they too speaking out when they have some personal risk? Are they addressing the racism inherent in their organizational structures? Are they still contributing financially to Black Lives Matter or other activist organizations? I, of course, don't know. However, I do know donations and engagement in Black Lives Matter has fallen off quite a bit. And according to NBC data, this was March of 2022, the number of Black people killed by police has actually increased over the last 2 years from George Floyd's murder. Many of us are Black, including myself. I'm all in this with you. Many of us are back to our white bubble, saddened by it all, but for the most part turned away. I'm here because I believe that people turned away because it's a really complex issue. No one solution is going to make this better, and people feel a bit paralyzed. And I believe many people who share our values do want to do more. So when I say action, take action, what comes to mind? Take a few moments with yourself. Take another big breath. Feel your seat and your feet. Try not to censure what comes up. But what comes to mind when you think of taking action? Again, feel free to stand up, move around. Our embedded hidden racism is important for white people who identify as liberal to focus on. Back in Colorado, I was witness to many UU congregations and other churches trying to tackle their internal racism. Seems a bit of a no-brainer for UUs, but all of them struggle mightily. Many white people, especially who see themselves as the good guys, often decompensate into anger, tears, and worse when confronted with even the idea they might be racist. I look back and know I did this when I was first addressed or confronted by a Black woman in my UU congregation back in the day. And actually, it was that reaction, my just reactive, defensive anger, how could you, that got my notice to say, there's something here. This is, you know, I'm acting like a fool here. I don't understand it. So let's look at the words of James Baldwin, and there's a slide here, George. And Black people from all walks of life today say these are still true. My experience with liberals, they have attitudes. They have all the proper attitudes. But they have no real convictions, and when the chips are down and you expect them to deliver and what you thought they felt, somehow they are not there. Or to put it another way, as long as white Americans take refuge in their whiteness, for as long as they are unable to walk out of this most monstrous of traps, they will allow millions of people to be slaughtered in their name and will be manipulated into and surrender themselves to what they will think of and justify as a racial war. We see this now in our prison pipeline, where although 13% of our population is Black, 38% of those in prison are Black, and 27% of the people killed by police are Black. For the most, we're not out in the streets by the millions, and for the most part, we stay silent. A few weeks ago, so take a deep breath, feel your seat and your feet, move around. A few weeks ago in the service about our one prisoner, one parish, we were asked to raise our hands if we felt this fellowship is a safe space for Matthew. I couldn't raise my hand. The statistics that back what James Baldwin is talking about are too strong. I don't know this congregation, but the statistics kind of speak for themselves. Although the intent, I'm sure, is 100%, the chance that this is a truly safe space in the long run is small. I recognize that the impact of saying this might feel harsh and judgmental, and I don't intend it that way. But there is quite an evidence base to say that this is true. And our duty really is to look at and say, how aren't we safe? Well, let's work on it. In some ways, it's kind of simple. It's like, don't know how we're not going to be safe for him, but let's work on it. So the thing that might make us a safe space for him and others hinges on whether we have a focus on learning about our own racism as individuals and a congregation. Never going to be perfect, but if we're transparent and learning, then even when we make mistakes and things happen, we will be safe because we'll be here, we'll be grounded, we'll be authentic, we'll be human, we'll be loving. What we have the power to do, in a couple weeks, the service, the Mistakes and Miracles group. I remember when Donna wrote up it's in the spring, a summary of that book group, and there were some really good insights in there. So I'm really looking forward to that service and the insights it might bring to all of us about what we might do. So what we have the power to do is to bring our internalized racism to light, layer after layer. I see my own as an onion. I work on it. I'm like, I got this, I'm an anti-racist, and then something happens that I do or don't do, and it's like, like the walk in the park the other day, or, you know, different things, and it's like, that's my growing edge. My current growing edge is to say things to people in my friends and family group where I have a personal risk. This isn't hard for me to be up here saying this, but to talk to someone who does something, that's going to be really hard, but there's people doing that here now in a powerful way. So I want to wrap up with a few thoughts of what to do, because we all like, how can we fix this, which is challenging. There's tons of resources. Part of why I didn't get into like all kinds of things that we can do is there's tons of resources online. I'm always happy to talk to people about what I like to read or podcasts, conversations I like to have. There's tons of stuff, so happy to talk to anyone who's interested in looking for that. But I do think, and there's a slide for this, George, it's the last one. I do think that crucial action for white people is to have an ongoing practice of learning about their own internalized racism that we've spoken up here today, how it shows up in the world, and simply try to do better. Maya Angelou says, do your best, and when you have more knowledge, do better. I believe this kind of work is the root of other actions. If you sit around thinking, what can I do? Without this kind of work, not sure the actions are going to be sustainable or as impactful as we might want. So a couple of things you can do, couldn't leave without some list. Listen to Black people and brown and Asian and others. How can you listen? Podcasts, books, authors, friends and family, read novels by non-white authors, all kinds of things like that. With curiosity and open mind, and most importantly, believe them. I used to find myself arguing, that's not racist, or this is, it's like, who the F am I to say what it's like to be Black? And I'm arguing with them in my mind. It's ridiculous. So just believe them. In the end, you can sort through what your own nuance might be or what you think about it. Acknowledge your privilege just because you have white skin. You can go anywhere and walk anywhere and not have that gaze on you. Don't have to worry about your kids walking on the street, all that kind of stuff. You've heard all of that. Be sensitive to the context and issues that are important to Black people and what they consider harm to be microaggressions. they're called. People sometimes make fun of that. And try not to do those things. They are hurtful to people. Identify your own growing edge and work on it. And get comfortable talking about racism, your own and ours. It'll be messy, we'll have mistakes, and the world will be better for it. So that's it. Take another deep breath. Let it all settle a little bit. We have a closing hymn, so just keep breathing. Let it flow through. Feel free to get up and move and dance if you'd like, or sing. We've got good singers here. So thank you very much.